to these days together, and hope that you will take your pastor's admonition to be in your spot and be faithful. My dad was saved in revival meetings in 1930. He was 9 years old, and those revival meetings went for 6 weeks every night, including Saturday night. So be thankful you don't live in 1930. That's all I got to say. But anyway, as Pastor said, you know, God can do great things in one day if he wants to. But the more that we give ourselves to the Lord, obviously, the more he can soften and tender our hearts to what he wants to do. And so I'm glad that you're here for this very first session. Take your Bible. Let's go to the book of Micah, chapter number 6. The book of Micah. Give you a chance to find it. Tucked away, one of the minor prophets. And even if you have the books of the Bible memorized, you can't remember which one's in front of it or behind it. So just look for a moment there. If you need the table of contents, that's fine too. We do that with every other book, so no problem using that with the Bible as well. Micah chapter 6, and I want to start reading verse number 1, and we'll read down to verse number 8. Micah chapter 6, verse 1. Hear ye now what the Lord saith. Arise, contend thou before the mountains, and let the hills hear thy voice. Hear ye, O mountains, the Lord's controversy, and ye strong foundations of the earth. For the Lord hath a controversy with his people, and he will plead with Israel. Now, let me pause to say, it's never good when God has a controversy with his people. I don't think any of us want to walk out of church today saying, boy, I'm glad the Lord's mad at me. I'm glad the Lord's got a bone to pick with me. No, this was serious. God had a controversy with his people. Look at verse 3. O my people, what have I done unto thee? And wherein have I wearied thee? Testify against me. He says, come on, talk to me. What have I done? What's the problem here? Obviously, the problem is never with God. It's with his people. And he's saying, look, there's a problem. Talk to me. What's going on? Verse 4. For I brought thee out of the land of Egypt and redeemed thee out of the house of servants. And I sent before thee Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember now what Balak the king of Moab consulted and what Balaam the son of Beor answered him from Shittim unto Gilgal, that ye may know the righteousness of the Lord. He said, I'm the one that saved you. I'm the one that brought you out of Egypt. I redeemed you. And I set leadership before you to guide you. Remember these things now. I've done my part, God is saying. I've been faithful to you. Well, Israel is starting to get worried here now in verse number 6. And they said, wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? They're saying, Lord, don't get mad, God. Give us a chance here. What do you want? You want us to bring an offering? Do you want a burnt sacrifice? Do you want some rivers of oil? Do you want our firstborn son? Lord, just tell us. We'll do whatever you need. Just don't get mad at us. Don't destroy us. Verse 8. He has showed thee, O man, what is good. And what doth the Lord require of thee? But to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God. God says, no, I don't want a sacrifice. I don't want your offerings. I don't want your firstborn son. I have three requirements. Do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. I think you could sum that up in the word responsibility. Taking your responsibility before God. Now, we're not real good at responsibility these days. We're pretty good at blame shifting. We're pretty good at excuses. We're pretty good at passing the buck. But when it comes to, you know, owning up to a wrong, when it comes to making things right, making restitution, we're not real good at that. I looked up the word responsibility in the dictionary, and here's what I found. Responsibility. The social force that binds you to the courses of action demanded by that force. The social force that binds you to the courses of action demanded by that force. Well, I'm going to be honest, I don't like that definition. Not because I necessarily don't want to agree with it, but if responsibility is the social force that binds me to the courses of action demanded by that force, well, I don't have to be honest because society doesn't demand that. I don't have to be faithful to my wife. Culture doesn't demand that. I don't have to work hard at my job. Nobody demands that anymore. So what is responsibility? How would God define responsibility? What is God speaking of when he says to be responsible for our life? Well, I sort of thought about that definition that the dictionary gives, and I thought about what the Bible would teach, and here's what I came up with. Responsibility. The created conscience that binds us to the courses of action designed by our Creator. The created conscience. We all have a conscience, right? You all know what it's like to have a guilty conscience. We all have a conscience. Guess who gave you your conscience? God did. In fact, Romans chapter 2 tells us that he's written his word on our hearts, our conscience also bearing witness. So our conscience is God-given. It's something that God has put within us to make us aware of his moral principles, his ethical principles, his word. So we have a created conscience, and it's that created conscience that binds us to the courses of action designed by the one who made us, our Creator. So if God were giving his opinion this morning, would he say that our lives are being lived according to the purpose that he designed for us to live them? Let's look at verse 8 carefully this morning, and let's see these three requirements that God sets down for us to be responsible. First of all, he gives us a principal duty. He says, I want you to do justly. Now, the word do would indicate an action or a duty. So to do justly is a principal duty. It's what Paul said, let your conversation, let the way that you live be as it becometh the gospel of Christ. That whether I come and see you or else I be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. In other words, doing what is right, not just when everybody's around watching, not just when it's advantageous to you, but let your lifestyle, let the way that you live always bring honor and glory to Jesus Christ. Now, that principal duty would involve an honest word. Do you tell the truth? They say the average person lies between 6 and 10 times a day. You say, oh, not me. Be careful, that's one. Do you tell the truth? Do you tell the truth to yourself? You know, it's really amazing in the Bible. The Bible tells us that the devil tries to deceive us, the world deceives us, our flesh deceives us, the sin deceives us. But you know, it's amazing how many times God warns us about deceiving our own selves. Do you tell the truth to yourself? When pastor's up here preaching, are you sitting there thinking, yeah, that's for so-and-so? I don't need that. Do you tell the truth to yourself? Do you tell the truth to God? Someone has said, Baptists don't lie. They don't tell lies. They just come to church and sing them. I mean, we every Sunday we come in here and we sing these songs. Oh, how I love Jesus. Lie. I surrender all. Lie. Have thine own way, Lord. Lie. Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord of thee. Lie. Do we tell the truth to God? Do we tell the truth to one another? Our spouse, our children, our parents, our coworkers, our church members. Do we have an honest word? The writer in Hebrews in chapter 13, verse 18, he said, in all things willing to live honestly? Are we living honestly? Proverbs 23:23 says, buy the truth and sell it not. You want to make a good investment? Buy the truth and don't ever sell. Why? Because lying lips are an abomination unto the Lord, but they that deal truly are his delight. See, way back in the book of Leviticus, when God was laying down the law for his people, he said, ye shall not steal, neither lie, thou shalt not steal, neither lie one to another. And Paul expands upon this in the book of Ephesians. He said, wherefore put away the lying. Let every man speak the truth with his neighbor. We're to gird our loins with truth. Because the lip of truth shall be established forever. But a lying tongue is but for a moment. So to do justly, this principal duty involves an honest word, but it also involves an honorable walk. Does your way match your say? Does your walk match your talk? Is perception reality? To do justly is more than just believing the right thing. It's more than just having the right doctrine, the right beliefs. John said in 1 John chapter 2, he said, little children, let us not love in word and in tongue, but in deed and in truth. In fact, in 1 John chapter 2, in verse 6, he says, he that saith he abideth in him ought himself also so to walk, even as he walked. If we could throw a PowerPoint up on this screen, and on this PowerPoint, we had the steps of Jesus Christ. And then over the top of that PowerPoint, we brought another PowerPoint that showed our steps. How close would they match? When you got in those waters of baptism, you pictured the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the Bible says in Romans 6:4, therefore we are buried with him by baptism into death, that like as Christ was raised up from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. How new is your walk since you've been saved? Is it different? Are your steps different? See, to do justly involves an honorable walk, to walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise. But to do justly would also involve a holy work. How do you view work? Ah, I got to go to work. Got to bring home the bacon. Can't wait to retire. How do you view work? You know, a lot of people think work is a result of sin. You know, Adam blew it in the garden, so God put him to work. Well, that's not true. In fact, did you know God works? Genesis chapter 2, verse 1 says, on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had created and made and rested from all his work which he had made. In Psalm 8, verse 3, when I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained. Jesus said in John 9, and verse 4, I must work the works of him that sent me while it's day, for the night cometh when no man can work. So if work is a result of sin, God's got a problem. And God told the pastor, if he desires the office of a bishop, he desires a good work. He told Timothy, do the work of an evangelist. So work is not a result of sin. Now, when Adam and Eve sinned, their work became more toilsome. It proved sweat in their face, the thorns, the thistles, you know, but they were put to work long before that. In Genesis 2, they're created. In Genesis 2 and verse 15, they were placed in the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. They were put to work. And God expects that our work become a holy work. Bob Jones Sr. used to say to the Christian, there's no difference between the secular and the sacred. And that really is true. Because whether we eat or drink or whatsoever we do, we're to do all to the glory of God. In Ephesians 6 and verse 6, Paul wrote, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will doing service as to the Lord and not unto men. For whatsoever good thing any man doeth, the same shall he receive of the Lord, whether he be bond or free. Do you realize that Ephesians 6:6-8 was written to slaves? I know that because verse 9 starts talking to the masters. and how they're supposed to treat their slaves. And God says, you better treat them right because I'm your master in heaven and I'm going to treat you the way you treat your slaves. So Ephesians 6, 6 to 8 is written to slaves. Now, the last time I checked, slaves didn't earn any wages. Slaves didn't have a benefit package. Slaves didn't have a retirement plan. But God said to those slaves, you do your work, not to that master. You do it as unto the Lord. You see, you make it a holy work. You know, if your pastor came to you and he said, listen, I want to talk to you for a minute. He said, I've really been praying. We've got a need in our ministry. We've got a little hole in one of our ministries, and I don't know what it'd be. Maybe an usher, maybe a nursery worker. I don't know what it might be. But pastor came to you and he said, we've got a little bit of need in our church, and I've really been praying about this, and every time I pray about it, God puts you on my heart. And I just want to ask you, if you would prayerfully consider stepping into this ministry in our church and serving with us here in this way. Well, man, if your pastor came to you with that approach, you'd probably think, boy, I better pray about this. And you'd go home, you'd pray, and the Lord would perhaps impress upon your heart that that's what you should do, and you'd go back to your pastor and say, Pastor, if God put me on your heart for this, and I believe that that's what God would have me do, and boy, I'll sign up. And so you become an usher, or you become a nursery worker, or you start doing this or that. And I just have a feeling that you would want to do that as unto the Lord. I mean, this is the church house. This is God's work. This is the ministry. And you'd come to church or that opportunity, and you'd say, boy, Lord, I want to do this unto you. This is your work. You'd want to do it well. But you know, maybe if we looked at the factory tomorrow morning or the office tomorrow morning the same way we look at the church house, if we looked at our work tomorrow morning at the office like we look at the work we do here at church, maybe there'd be as much ministry at the office as there is at the church. A holy work. So he says, I have a principal duty to do justly. But then he goes on. He says, I want a peaceful demonstration. I want you to love mercy. Wow. That's not really natural, is it? To love mercy? I mean, what do we do when somebody kind of messes with us? Somebody kind of irritates us? Somebody messes up, or they do something behind our back, or they do something to irritate us. What's our first reaction? Well, our first reaction is to get even. You know, somebody cuts us off in traffic. Wait till I get up there, boy. Give that guy a piece of my mind. Be careful. You only have so many pieces to give away. But, you know, our first reaction is, you know, I'm going to make him pay. Well, be careful. God says, I want you to love mercy. Now, to do that, it starts with rejecting revenge. Our first response when somebody does something wrong toward us, some injustice, something that doesn't, isn't kind or isn't right, our first reaction is to get even, to do back to them what they've done to us. But you know what Proverbs 24 and verse 29 says? Say not thou, I will do so to him as he hath done to me. I'll render to the man according to his work. God says, don't say it. Don't even think it. In Proverbs 20, verse 22, say not thou, I'll recompense evil. Wait on the Lord, and he'll save thee. You see, again, back in the law, Leviticus 19, ye shall not steal, thou shalt not avenge, nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord. Again, Paul in Romans chapter 12, he says, dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for vengeance is mine, I'll repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if that enemy be hungry, give him bread to eat. If he be thirsty, give him water to drink, and thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head. Be not overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. We've got to reject revenge. Well, how are we going to do that in the heat of the moment? Remember redemption. If you're going to reject revenge, you got to remember redemption. Aren't you glad God doesn't get even? Wow. Suppose God got even. Friends, we wouldn't be in church this morning. We wouldn't be on planet Earth this morning. We'd be in a lake of fire. Not eventually, right now. Every sin we've ever committed is a slap in the face of a holy God. It's of the Lord's mercies that we're not consumed. His compassions fail not. They're new every morning. Wow. The Lord's merciful and gracious. Slow to anger. Plenteous in mercy. In fact, here in Micah chapter 7, verse 18, it says, He delighteth in mercy. Delights in it. So God says we got to reject revenge, but in order to do that, we're going to have to remember redemption. And then he wants us to rejoice in restoration. Loving mercy is more than just saying, okay, I forgive you, forget it. I'll just, you know, it's no problem. It's okay. He says, I want you to rejoice in restoration. In Galatians 6, verse 1, brethren, speaking to us that are saved, brethren, if any man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest also be tempted. Now, the word restore there is a very interesting word. The Greek word there is actually a medical term. And it comes, what it means is to reset as you would reset a broken bone. You ever broken a bone? How many of you have broken a bone? Broken an arm or leg? Okay, several of you have. You know, I was pretty fortunate in my life. I grew up on a farm and worked with a lot of animals, a lot of machinery, never broke anything. Pretty fortunate. Played sports, started playing basketball in fifth grade, football in seventh grade, played all the way through college, ran some track in high school as well, never broke anything. Had some injuries, but never broke anything. My young adult life, did some crazy things. Few car accidents, never broke anything. Very fortunate. Until a couple years ago, I took up cycling. Maybe about 10 years ago. Started riding bike, and I really enjoy it. And I take my bike with me, and I just like to ride. And about 3 or 4 years ago, I was in Tennessee. It was during the summer, and I was preaching at the Bill Rice Ranch. And I got up one morning. I like to ride early in the morning, and I got up early, but it was raining, just downpours. I thought, can't ride today. So I preached chapel and got through the morning, and after lunch, I drove into town, drove into Murfreesboro. I needed to get the oil changed on my car. My next trip was up to Connecticut, and so I thought, I better get that oil changed today. So I drove into town, drove in the oil place, and the rain was actually letting up, and the clouds looked like they were breaking up, and I said to myself as I went into that oil change place, I said, you know what? When I get out of here, if it's not raining, I'm gonna drive into town. I'm going to ride for a little bit. So I came out of the oil place, and sure enough, didn't need the wipers, just kind of a little mist, and clouds were breaking, sun was trying to peek through. So I thought, I'm going to ride. So I drove to a park there in Murfreesboro, parked the car, got my bike out of the trunk and put it together. And there's a greenway that goes through Murfreesboro. It follows the little river that goes through town, and I'd ridden it before. It's a nice paved path and goes for several miles. And so I thought, this is great. So I got on my bike. I went about a quarter of a mile. And about a quarter mile into that trail, the trail goes underneath the freeway, and it goes down, and then it goes into a curve, and it goes under the freeway. Well, where it goes under the freeway, instead of blacktopping the trail, they cemented it. Probably because of the water that goes through there. They cemented the trail. And I got to that cement. I'm going down this decline into the curve about 20 miles an hour when I noticed that there was still water running across the trail. And in Tennessee, the ground is clay. It's red clay, and it looked like blood running across the trail. And I said to myself, I thought, whoa, that looks slippery. The next thing I knew, front of my bike, the front wheel hit that clay, and the bike went one way, and I went another way. Now, I've crashed before on my bike, and normally you can kind of ride the bike, and the bike takes the hit, but not this time. I was off the bike before I knew what had happened. And my bike went into the split rail fence that was guarding the trail on the right, and I went skidding on that cement about 20 feet on my left shoulder. Well, I came to a stop, and I jumped up, and my first thought was, did anybody see that? That's embarrassing. My next split second thought was, I felt nauseated. In fact, the only other time I ever felt like that was when I had a concussion in football in college. My next split second thought was, I have this searing pain in my left shoulder. I went over to the bike and I picked it out of the split rail fence with my right arm and I kind of set it up and I thought, this is crazy, I'm not going to ride anymore. I'm going back. And I went to get on that bike, but I couldn't put any pressure at all on my left side. So I walked the bike back that quarter mile to my car and I managed to get it into my trunk one-handed and I drove back to the ranch. And for the next 3 hours, I successfully got undressed, took a shower, and got dressed for church. Went in and preached one-handed. All the gestures were with my right hand, and just left my left hand where God put it, you know, just preached with the right hand. And after the service, Dr. Bill Rice III, he came up and he said, Brother Getch, what is wrong with your left hand? I said, Dr. Bill, not a thing. My left hand is fine, but my left shoulder's killing me. I told him what happened. He took me down to the little clinic there at the ranch, and they had a sling. They put it in a sling. I managed to get a little sleep that night. Well, the next morning I went in, preached chapel, and then they said, now, we made an appointment for you at the doctor. You better go get it checked out. So I went into town. Well, the doctor, he was a cyclist, too. He liked to ride bike, too, and he knew exactly where I'd crashed and was very interested in knowing how it happened. And he said, well, what'd you do after you crashed? I told him what I did. And he said, oh, you probably just bruised it. But he said, we probably better take an x-ray. So now I'm off to Middle Tennessee Hospital. And I go into the lab, and there's a nice, very nice African-American lady there doing the x-rays, and she's saying, turn this way, and she'd take the picture, and she'd go, whoa, wow. And I said, what do you see? She said, I can't tell you. I turn this way. Turn another way. She'd take another picture. Whoa, wow. I said, what do you see? She said, I can't tell you. We did about 7 or 8 of those. Finally, I said, ma'am, what do you see? She said, well, I'm not allowed to tell you, but you can come look at it. Well, I went back there. I looked at it. But I'm not an x-ray technician. I don't know what I'm looking for. I'm just seeing white and black. People come up to me and they show me the ultrasound of their baby. Don't do that. I don't know what I'm looking at. Oh, that's that. Wow. Yeah, look, it's a boy. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, sure is. Wow. I don't have any idea what I'm looking for. So I said, ma'am, I'm not seeing it. She said, look, it's broke here and it's broke here. A perfect cross. Nothing like wearing your religion on your sleeve, you know? Well, now I'm off to the orthopedic. And another fine African-American lady, very fine surgeon, she examined the x-ray, examined me. She said, Mr. Getch, if you were my patient, if you lived here, I would not do surgery. She said, amazingly, your bones in your shoulder are broken 2 places, but she said, they have reset absolutely perfectly. And if you'll keep this shoulder quiet, you'll just keep it still for the next couple weeks, and then you get back to your doctor and let him x-ray it again. If it stays where it is, you won't need any surgery. You'll just need some therapy. But if it moves, you're going to need to have surgery. Well, I didn't bother to tell her. I was driving to Connecticut and then to California back, but she didn't ask, so I didn't tell her. And I managed the next couple of weeks to get to Connecticut and preach and then to California, and I got back and I had it re-x-rayed, and it stayed in that spot. And through some therapy, I'm able to use it again. Now, I learned something through all that. We have in our body what doctors call bone glue. It's not the medical term, it's the layman's terms, bone glue. It runs through our body constantly. If you break something, the brain automatically sends that bone glue to the crack in the bone, and it fills that crack immediately. And your body produces massive amounts of this stuff upon breaking a bone, and it all goes to that crack in the bone, and it fills that crack. And doctors tell us that that bone glue is so strong that it actually becomes stronger than the bone marrow, so that it's almost impossible to break the same bone in the same place twice. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's the word that God uses when he says, I want you to restore someone who has sinned. Wouldn't it be something if in the local church body, like the bone glue in the physical body, instead of when somebody sins or messes up or does us wrong, instead of us running to Facebook or rushing to pick up our phone, we would rush to the break like the bone glue in the physical body, and we would get there and help restore that brother so that he would actually be stronger in that area than he would have ever been had he not sinned in the first place. That's what it means to love mercy. Reject revenge. You can only do that by remembering redemption. But he says, I want you to go the second mile and rejoice in restoration. So we've got a principal duty. We've got a peaceful demonstration. But now, folks, it gets real hard. He says, I want a prevailing demeanor. I want you to walk humbly with thy God. Oh, boy. Lord, did you have to bring this up too? Walk humbly? That's perhaps the toughest of all. You know, if we did a little exit interview on the way out of Sunday school this morning, put somebody at the door, and asked one question of everybody moving out: what is your view of homosexuality? Well, I suppose from a class like this at a Baptist church, I suppose there'd be maybe several different types of answers, but I think probably one that might be used often from a group like this would be, well, I believe it's an abomination unto the Lord. And according to Leviticus 18, verse 24, that is what the Bible says. If a man lies with a man or a woman with a woman, it's an abomination to the Lord. But what if somebody was standing at the door and asked us, what is your view of pride? I doubt if anybody'd say, well, I believe it's an abomination unto the Lord. But that's what God says. God made a list of his top seven abominations. And I checked. Homosexuality didn't make the list. Now, I'm not cutting a sin any slack here. But pride is still number one. These six things doth the Lord hate. These seven are an abomination unto him. A proud look. We can preach against the social issues of our day. But friends, God is saying, look, I want this prevailing demeanor of humility. Well, God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah for their wicked lifestyle. He brought down fire and brimstone upon people who lived in that kind of a wicked sodomite relationship. Whoa, hang on. Keep reading. Again, I'm not cutting anybody any slack here on sins. But in Ezekiel 16 and verse 49, behold, this was the sin of thy sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, an abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters. God said, I destroyed those cities for three sins. Three sins, by the way, that are being committed in fundamental Baptist churches. Pride, affluence, and laziness. Now, there was homosexuality in Sodom and Gomorrah. You better believe there was. But that was a byproduct. See, somehow we've made pride an acceptable abomination. Well, it's not like some of this other stuff. Wait a minute. In Revelation 3, we have the church at Laodicea, and we like to get on them for their apathy, their indifference. They weren't doing anything for God. But when God came to that church, he said, I would that thou art cold or hot. Thou art neither cold nor hot, but thou art lukewarm. I'm ready to spew you out of my mouth. It makes me sick. I'm ready to regurgitate. Because thou sayest, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing. Pride. I can handle this, God. I don't need revival. I don't need more services. I don't need the Bible. I don't need church. I don't need God. I can handle it. Pride. An acceptable abomination. But I got to tell you, when we accept this abomination of pride in our life, there's an awaiting ambush. Because pride goeth before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. When we allow pride in our life, God says, you're going down. It's an amazing example of how God illustrates that in Acts chapter 12 and verse 21. On a set day, Herod, arrayed in royal apparel, sat upon a throne and he made an oration. He made a speech. And the people gave a shout. They said, it's the voice of a God and not a man. And immediately, the angel of the Lord smote him because he gave not God the glory, and he was eaten of worms and gave up the ghost. Now notice that. He didn't die, and then the worms of corruption ate his flesh in the ground. No, this guy was eaten of worms, and then he died. Why? He didn't give God the glory. Anything happened in the last 7 days you didn't give God glory for? God's given you 86,400 seconds today. Did you take one of them to thank him? And by the way, that's Acts 12. That's New Testament. That's the church age. This pride thing is a problem. He said, I want a prevailing demeanor. We've made pride an acceptable abomination. It has an awaiting ambush. But you know, there's an amazing thing about this matter of humility. There's an astonishing ascension. God speaks in some paradoxes. For instance, he says, except a corn of wheat fall in the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. It's like when Paul said, I'm crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live. Wait a minute, how can you be crucified and yet live? And here's another one. God says, he that humbleth himself shall be exalted. You see, with God, the way up is down. We think, well, I got to pad my resume. I got to make myself look good. I got to put on an aura. No, no, no. God says, humble yourself in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up in due time. There's an astonishing ascension when we're willing to humble ourselves. And by the way, it is a do-it-yourself project. If my people which are called by my name shall humble themselves. Don't wait for God to humble you. He can do it. But he wants us at the eve of this revival meeting to humble ourselves before him. How responsible are we? God's got a controversy with these folks. I don't suppose there's any sense in going any further in a revival meeting if God's at odds with us. The requirements are simple. They're very succinct. They're not easy. But I want you to do justly, principal duty. An honest word, an honorable walk, a holy work. I want a peaceful demonstration. Reject revenge. Remember redemption. Rejoice in restoration. Then I want a prevailing demeanor. I want humility in your life. I want you to not accept this abomination because there's an awaiting ambush if you do. But there's an astonishing ascension when we humble ourselves. God begins to use our life in amazing fashion. By the way, if you're not saved, you're not responsible. Because remember, responsibility is our created conscience, which demands that we live according to the Creator's design. Well, the Creator's design, you know why we're here? You know why we exist? Revelation 4:11, thou art worthy and to receive glory, honor, power, and blessing, for thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created. The only reason you and I are breathing right now is to bring glory to God, to bring pleasure to God. The problem is we're sinners, and sin broke our fellowship with God. As a sinner, you cannot fulfill your created purpose. Impossible.
Because sin separates you from that God that he created you for. So the only way to be restored to God is through Jesus Christ. Ye that were sometime afar off are made nigh by the blood of Jesus Christ. The only way that you can be responsible to God is to be a Christian. And the only way to become a Christian is through Jesus Christ. So if you're not saved, the first step is to get saved. As a Christian, are we living as God's designed us to live? As he created us to live, according to his design. Revival meetings are all about getting us back in the steps of Jesus Christ, getting back to the truth of his word and following him as he designed us to live. Let's be responsible. I don't want to leave with a controversy with God. Be one thing for this guy and I to be mad at each other. That might not be a big deal, at least temporarily. But to not be right with God, to have a controversy with God, that's a problem. Because if I'm not right there, guess what? I'm not going to be right there either. I'm not going to be right anywhere. When a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. So we got to get right with him. Let's bow for prayer. Lord, thank you for these folks being where they need to be and should be on a Sunday morning, and I'm grateful for that.